This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you'll indulge me for a moment of personal reflection, this seems like both a perilous and crucial time to be a journalist. I don't pretend to suggest that doing news in the United States is anywhere near the danger of doing it in a place where your life is in jeopardy from militants or drug cartels or even your own government's actors. But there is no love lost in this country for people who report the news. And for news consumers, it's a confusing time. The internet and the rise of citizen journalism was supposed to open up the world of ideas and stories and headlines, make journalism a populist movement where things that weren't getting covered by the news behemoths could find daylight and eyeballs. And that's been true to some extent. But the other edge of that sword is that all kinds of information, misinformation, and misleading information is also coming at us full pelt, full speed. It's hard to separate fact from fiction, opinion from unbiased reporting. In some cases, that obfuscation is intentional. And often solid reporting is dismissed by people who hold a fierce opinion on the matter being discussed as fake news, even when it isn't. So the challenge is great and, I would argue, more important than ever. Today on the show, we're going to talk a little bit about this idea of fake news and how you can source your information. We're going to look at the role, responsibility, and value of journalism and the responsibility of news consumers as well. I'm joined today by David Mindich, professor of media studies, journalism, and digital arts at St. Michael's College. Hi, David. Nice to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
And we're joined by Orion Lewis, a visiting professor of political science at Middlebury College. Professor Lewis, nice to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Professor Mindich, it seems like an obvious question, but what is fake news?
Well, fake news there's a whole fake news industry, and it's basically news that's not true. It's not verified. It could be partially true, but by and large, what we're reading something that might appear to be true, but is not real.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, it's sort of opinion that's passed off as fact or one side of a story that's passed off as this is the news. But Orion Lewis, in some cases, it's content that is just completely fabricated. If you haven't read it yet, you should read an article that came out today in the New York Times that goes through and interviews a guy who wrote fake news. And he just created a headline, breaking news. All of these ballot items have been found in a box in Ohio. Hillary Clinton was trying to steal the election. It's fabricated. And it's passed off as news and then tweeted and retweeted and sent out on Facebook and discussed. And Orion Lewis, people believe it. I mean, it can look like regular news.
Yes. And I think this is partly what's difficult about this issue is there's a very slippery slope in terms of trying to define what is fake news. What is the line between, say, partisan spin on news versus something that's an outright fabrication? What's the difference between, say, just bad journalism without good fact-checking and fake news? But I think what you're getting at is there's also something more insidious here that is of a strategic nature. And I do a lot of work studying news in authoritarian settings, and one of the definitions of propaganda is something that is totally divorced from reality and used purely for spin or political purposes. So I think there is this more kind of insidious aspect to this that more closely resembles what I would call propaganda.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because in some cases we're learning that fake news is just designed to get clicks, and the actual reasoning behind it is because of ad revenue, because people can make money if they come up with something that's fake, but people read it. And, you know, the things that may grab the headlines may sound like actual news stories, like something that has happened in the election cycle, but there's no purpose behind it other than to get money. But Professor Lewis, you're talking about actual propaganda, and you know, this gets us into that idea of maybe a partially true story or a one-sided story, and you're seeing more of that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I put this issue of fake news within the context of a lot of long-term structural changes that have been taking place to our media landscape. One is the kind of increased partisanship within media, starting with talk radio and then moving on to cable news. There's also this kind of commercial and sensationalism logic, which I think you're referring to, that's it's about you know, generating likes or views or attention. But all this comes within the context of the internet revolution, which has reduced the ability of the traditional media to act as the agenda setters and the arbiters of truth. And so news is much more fragmented, driven by social media, internet, a variety of sources. And I think that means that all interests motivated by different sorts of things, some of them political, can take advantage of that situation.
Professor Mindich, are you seeing propaganda, or what you could, you know, could actually call propaganda, being perpetuated in the news? And I put news in quotes here.
Yes, absolutely. And for the reasons that you mentioned, the New York Times had an article a few months ago about this Georgian undergraduate student from this former Soviet country of Georgia, who just to make money was starting to generate fake news. He found out that he couldn't really sell fake news to liberals, but that Trump supporters were eating it up. And it was just a money-making effort. And the, one of the problems is that at the very top of the ticket in, for the Republicans and now the president-elect is also a purveyor of fake news. And he often says things like, well, we just don't know. We don't know about Ted Cruz's father. I've heard things. And so the political climate, the agenda is set at the very top that, you know, we're not really sure about these facts. I've heard it on the internet. Part of it is that we traditionally have journalistic gatekeepers. But what happens if you're a gatekeeper but there's no fence, that there's no way to keep out fake information? The traditional news sources might have appeared as gatekeepers before, but now there's this tremendous tsunami of news and information and fake news that's really filtered by the user himself or herself on Facebook and other social media. And we're probably, as citizens, it's probably above or below our pay grade to try to monitor our own news.
Well, listeners, I'm curious where you come in on this conversation, how you are interpreting fake news, what you're doing to try to make sure that what you're reading is factual, if that's what you're looking for in your news. You know, how do you source your news? How do you double check before you repost on Facebook or retweet on Twitter? How do you know what sources to trust? And do you feel like you can trust the sources that you were always told you were supposed to trust? We're talking about fake news. We'd love your thoughts. 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or speaking of Facebook, you can go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page and post your thoughts there. Chris in South Burlington says, it was really sad to watch the descent of once great papers like the New York Times during this election. Opinion bled into many of their news stories, and like CNN, secretly feeding debate questions to Hillary Clinton in advance. The once trustworthy gray lady became almost an extension of the Democratic National Committee public relations arm. We need papers like the Times to retain their credibility as actual policy begins to emanate from a Trump presidency and Republican Congress. Instead, this past weekend, there they were doubling down on the unverified BuzzFeed fake news story about Trump Russian dossier generated by a shady intelligence agent. It's necessary to read at least five or six sources across the ideological spectrum to get a glimmer of the truth. There's a lot to unpack there. Orion Lewis, what are you thinking? I mean, first of all, here's Chris saying, I don't trust the sources that are considered or have long been considered trustworthy. And let's tackle that before we get into this question about the dossier, because that one's an interesting one to talk about as well. So what about this idea of people feeling like they can't trust sources that they are supposed to be able to trust?
Yeah, I think that this is a really difficult issue, in particular because there's a lot of evidence that conservatives in particular heavily distrust many traditional media sources, and not just the online variety, but the more traditionally reputable like the New York Times as well. And so I do think that media as an institution has been under assault. And I think this election in particular showed that I've never seen an election where journalism and media itself became the target of criticism as part of a rigged system to the extent that we saw this past time. And so it's very difficult. I think part of it, the responsibility relies with media organizations. I think sometimes media organizations have decided that sensationalism and entertainment is more important than a kind of fact-checking watchdog role. And so I think we need to see news organizations really protect that and value that watchdog role in a very robust way. But part of this is, I think, also rooted in partisanship and partisan trust of different types of news sources. And there's very few news sources. I believe a Pew study in 2014 showed that only the Wall Street Journal was the news source that was not more distrusted than trusted by at least some spectrum of the partisan divide.
Yeah, I remember that study too. It was interesting because it was looking at people's political persuasions and then asking them which sources they trust. And, you know, obviously the list was slightly different, but depending on what your political persuasion was, and there was some overlap in just a few sources. And do you trust this one? This question of traditional media or, you know, what we have now been hearing politicians since Sarah Palin calling the lamestream media or the mainstream media as a slur. David Mindich, that does make the job more difficult of organizations that are trying to do fact-checking, that are trying to do investigative journalism, that are trying to tackle a story from a straightforward angle. If people are being told by their politicians or by others, you can't trust that. That's the lamestream media. That's not true. They have a bias. I mean, you're already swimming against the tide. And then we have to acknowledge that powerful media does have a voice and an ability to sort of move the direction of the conversation. We do have a power over what we cover and what we don't cover and what gets a headline and what doesn't. I mean, how do you balance that need to cover many things, but also to defend yourself against a challenge that you're biased when, you know, you're trying not to be?
Well, you know, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, CNN, the top news organizations might have a left or right of center bias.
Would you include NPR in that, public radio?
I think maybe less so with NPR, but if you look at various news organizations, you can detect certain biases, and we could spend a whole show talking about bias. I spend much of a semester talking about bias with students. But if you listen to NPR, if you read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or see something on CNN, generally speaking, the reporter tries to take his or her bias out of the story. And the post that you just read, I have a significant disagreement with that post because
this from the listener, Chris.
Yes, because you know Chris lumped together New York Times, CNN, and BuzzFeed, and I think last week's story really indicated a very different stance on those by those news organizations. BuzzFeed printed an unverified set of rumors. You know, it was a former operative, perhaps for British intelligence. But most of all of the allegations about Trump and Russian prostitutes were unverified. And we saw the New York Times, CNN, and all of the reputable news sources not printing those allegations, describing that Russia might have information that they could use to blackmail Trump, which was a very important piece of information for the public to know, but they didn't describe the allegations. BuzzFeed really departed from traditional journalistic ethics and behaviors by printing it. So it's important not to lump all those news organizations together.
Well, let me play a little bit of audio here from the press conference that President-elect Trump had last week when CNN's Jim Acosta tried to ask a question of Donald Trump.
Question.
Go ahead.
No, Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Since you are attacking
no,
our news
not you.
Organization,
not you.
Can you give us a chance?
Your organization is terrible.
You are attacking our news organization.
Your organization is terrible. Let's go.
Ask a question, sir.
Go ahead.
Sir,
quiet. Quiet.
Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead. She's asking a question. Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude. No, I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir.
Go ahead.
Can you stay categorically that nobody... No, Mr. President-elect, that's not appropriate.
Now, see, there you have President-elect Trump calling CNN fake news. And David Mindich, as you were saying, what CNN did was report that President Obama and President-elect Trump had been briefed on this information that intelligence sources thought there might be information that could be used against Donald Trump. And so CNN did not report the contents of this dossier. They reported that this event had happened where these two powerful people had been briefed. But here you have the president-elect who has been elected to be our president claiming CNN is fake news. Now, how are people supposed to differentiate?
Well, the president doesn't get to decide what's fake news and what's real news. CNN was doing its job. The New York Times was doing its job by holding leaders accountable. And this is important whether it's President Obama or President Trump or President somebody else. The role of the press in part is to hold leaders accountable. It's also to introduce parts of society to each other that might not come in contact with each other, to verify, to present facts, to dig. But one of the central missions of the press is to hold leaders accountable. And it's not fake news if CNN is reporting that.
We're talking about fake news today. We're looking at how it operates, how it sort of plays with your mind. And we're going to as well talk about what responsibility we have as news consumers to make sure that we are aware of what our sources are and that we're not perpetuating fake news. Ray says people need to be very careful when choosing what information sources to consume and believe. This has always been true, but it's more true now in the internet age. People need to critically evaluate their sources. Look at where the story is coming from. Look at what the story is citing and check out those links. Are the links from legitimate factual sources? Check other sources and use good ones. Don't just check one dodgy source against another. People should also attempt to develop a decent sense of information smell, which I think that one can do if one reads fairly widely and is well informed, because some of these stories just reek of being bogus or massively distorted. I'm finding that people from some quarters are labeling as fake news various news stories, reports, or statistics with which they merely disagree, regardless of the actual merits of the information or source in question. Harris in Burlington says, I love Facebook for keeping up with friends and family, but to remedy the fake news problem, I will not read any news on it, period. This also addresses the echo chamber issue. And the Johnson State College Library tweeted, librarians can help with this. We try to have the most reliable sources and skills to assist people with sniffing out what's true or not. But Housecrow says, we Vermonters helped make the spreading of false information acceptable. For years, significant numbers of Vermonters have pretended that there's scientific debate about vaccines and helped to spread false information about them. For years, Vermonters have pretended that there is scientific debate about GMOs, where there is absolutely no scientific debate. It's the era of just saying stuff. Who cares if it's true? You just say stuff over and over again, and eventually people will start to believe it. It's frightening, but it is absurd to pretend that Vermont doesn't do it. Tell us what you think. You can post a note on our Facebook page or call 800-639-2211. We'll get deep into your calls and emails coming up. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. I'm talking today with St. Mike's journalism professor David Mindich and poli-sci professor Orion Lewis, who's doing a stint as a visiting professor at Middlebury College. We're talking about fake news, what it is, how to spot it, why it's so prevalent, and we're hearing from many of you as well. You can share your thoughts, how you source your news, what you think the difference is between bias and untruth. Call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to David calling in from Montpelier. Hi, David. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to mention that crowdsourcing saved Wikipedia, and I think that crowdsourcing function within Facebook, or maybe independent of Facebook, and covering all the fake news outlets could be could easily eliminate fake news as a source. I mean, it's so easy to weed these things out because as you mentioned, they smell to high heaven. And the other point I wanted to make is that calling out a politician like Mr. Trump for conflating fake news with with something he doesn't like is easy to do because fake news is a specific product by a specific set of websites. It's almost as a technical definition. So you don't really need to. It's very easy to call somebody out who conflates the two. Anyway, those are the two points I wanted to make.
Yeah, David, I take your point and I appreciate you making it. You know, one of the hard things as I see it, though, is the time now that officials have to spend on debunking fake news. I mean, you say it's easy to point out it, and that may be true, but that doesn't mean that then officials in towns and states and even at the federal level aren't having to respond to say, this is not true, and it's taking up time of people or even, you know, journalists is taking job time to say, this is true, this is not true. So it's interesting. You know, it may be easy to spot in some cases, but there are enough people who believe it that there is a time spent debunking it. Let's hear from Peter in Shelburne. Hi, Peter. What are you thinking about?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Jane?
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. Go right ahead, Peter.
Okay. You know, my concern is the next level beyond, like, the fact that, you know, people are putting fake news out there. I'm more concerned the fact that people so easily take it in and just go, oh, that's okay. That's right.
Yeah.
And people, you know, we're talking about checking for facts, but there's so many people who don't bother to check for facts. It's just a worry.
Yeah, Peter, I take your point as well. Orion Lewis, what do you think about this point that Peter brings up? You know, people are buying this stuff, and whether it's an intentional ignorance or whether it's presented by somebody you trust on social media and you therefore think it's true and it's not, or maybe you're not a savvy news consumer and it's difficult to check sources. You know, what about the idea that people are listening and believing fake news?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough because not everybody has the time to be, you know, an avid consumer of news and compare across sources and fact check. I definitely think that there is, you know, much greater onus on citizens to be able to have political awareness, to be educated, to be politically engaged and evaluating these things. I do think that there needs to be other institutions that help citizens do this for them, and I think that's why traditional media really needs to play a strong, robust watchdog role. I agree with the earlier caller, David, that there probably are going to need to be, you know, crowdsourced citizen types of websites that also provide some help with fact-checking and trying to identify truth from falsehoods.
You know, it's interesting because Snopes.com used to be a website that you went to for an urban legend or to find out, you know, oh, this person used to be, this celebrity was involved in a rumor, but it's not true. And more, I don't know if you look there, Professor Lewis, but you'll often find political fake news that's been debunked by Snopes.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with Snopes specifically, but it certainly makes sense. And I would imagine there needs to probably be a lot more websites doing something similar to that.
But do you think people have a responsibility to ferret out fake news themselves as well? Or, you know, is it the job of what could be argued is a too timid mainstream or traditional media to call out falsehoods?
Yeah, I mean, some of the onus has to be on citizens. And they do need to be more conscientious about the news that they consume and understand the credibility of the brand, the source, just like we would teach our students to look at. But I don't think we can put all of the work on top of citizens who are, you know, busy with their lives and may not have the time. I think there needs to be, if we're talking about something that takes time and is hard to evaluate, there needs to be other institutions and organizations helping to do that. And I think that is going to fall on all of it. It's media, it's professors and public intellectuals, it's other societal organizations that help play that role.
Professor Mindich?
Well, so 67% of Trump supporters say that unemployment went up during the Obama administration. It clearly did not. A lot of people, both Republicans and Democrats, think that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act are two different things. You know, basic things that citizens need to engage in, they're not doing. So it's important to put some of the blame on citizens. And there's a remedy for citizens not knowing that the unemployment rate is going up or down, or whether Obamacare is the Affordable Care Act. And that's to read a newspaper, to listen to NPR, to follow the news. It doesn't take that much time. I think too many of us have been distracted by the shiny object that's Facebook and Twitter. And we really need to, as part of our media diet, we need to sit down with a good newspaper or a good news organization every day. Just like we brush our teeth, we need to and consume good food. We need to have that as part of our daily ritual.
You know, you say that, but something like, for example, the Washington Post, which has very good investigative journalism, has had great stories, has, you know, an online presence, obviously, as all newspapers do, so you can read the stories there. I have found that I will click on a headline thinking I'm getting a news story from the Washington Post, and I start to read it and realize pretty quickly, oh, wait, this is an opinion piece. But that was not made clear to me and I know you have to be wary on Twitter, but if the Washington Post is tweeting out a headline, it's not necessarily making it clear to consumers, this is commentary, this is news. So, you know, it's not even as easy as just saying, just go to the Washington Post or the New York Times or CNN or NPR. It's not always clear what's opinion and what's fact, even in those sites.
That's true. And we often move towards the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal horizontally. We go through we go through Twitter or Facebook. It's important every once in a while to go vertically. Go to the NPR website, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and actually move through the different sections, which will become more apparent if you go through the website itself.
So use it like a traditional paper, look at the front page.
Yeah, I'm not saying to get rid of Facebook and to ignore entertainment or sports news, but it's important to keep informed. Some of the news we need help with. So if we see that the Pope has endorsed Trump, which was one of the fake news stories, we need help from traditional news organizations to help us see that that's not true. But just to having a general sense of knowledge, news knowledge and political knowledge, is an important part of being a citizen. And I have a lot of friends, educated friends, who say, oh, this election's just stressing me out. I need a news break. And I feel like telling them, you know, take 5 minutes and then get back to it, because we all need to be informed and be aware.
Let's go to Daniel, calling in from Essex Junction. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. And, well, this topic was the main topic on a recent On Point. And at the end of the day, they simply concluded that ordinary citizens were all going to have to become competent journalists and be able to do what journalists do to figure out what's fake and what's not. I totally disagree with On Point on that item. I find it's a really good show, along with Vermont Edition, but I think they missed the boat very badly on that. I've heard opinions much closer to my own from you this morning or this afternoon about starting with trusted sources such as New York Times, Wall Street Journal, CNN, public radio, public television. Start there. But one piece that's really missing is, how do you find the fact checkers if you want to check on more depth or different topics than happen to be the choice of the day for the mainstream media? So how do you do it? How do you go about becoming a fact checker? How do you figure out who's fact checking is trustworthy?
Yeah, Daniel, interesting question there. Orion Lewis, what do you think?
I think there are some reputable fact-checking organizations, PolitiFact, and others like it that have a fairly good kind of nonpartisan, unbiased reputation. So I would probably start there.
It's been interesting in this latest election cycle, you know, with technology improving, you can find live fact checking on sites like NPR during the debates. And so you get these facts checked, you know, not quite in real time, but within 5 minutes or so, you can see journalists on other sites as well saying, actually, here's what we know about, you know, this federal policy. So there are ways, Daniel, to look at, you know, fact checkers coming in on live events. But yeah, it is that question of, you know, how do you know which sources to trust? And you know, if you are trying to be your own journalist, whether or not we all can, you know, how do you find those sources? Let me get another call in here while we're talking about all of this. John is on the line with us from Richmond. Hi, John. What are you thinking?
Hello, Jane. How are you today?
Well, thanks.
Good. I guess I have much higher expectations of all parties involved. I think if you're not spending a portion of your time keeping up to date on current events, facts, whatever, then you won't be able to tell the difference between fake news because you won't have the context in which to evaluate it. The same with the media. The media became respectable because they exercised editorial review. And they had somebody curating, for lack of a better term, the news, making decisions on what was important. You mentioned the fact of, you know, clicking on a headline and having it be a different story or a different tone or whatever. In an era where we're where whoever yells the loudest gets the attention, and then we'll deal with the aftermath later. It's a heck of a way to run a country, and I guess I expect more of all parties. I disagree with your panelist who said that people don't have time. People have time to post all sorts of, for lack of a better term, crap on Facebook, and yet they don't have enough time to do the minimum to educate themselves about their own school budget.
John, you expect more from everybody. Do you think you will see more? Do you think this is going to improve, or are we going down some terrible spiral and we're still headed down?
I don't think anything is irreversible. I just thinking you have to point out the trend before people go, oh,
well,
he might be right on that. I think if people point out 120 years ago, the big papers, the New York Herald, you know, Pulitzer and Hearst, and all those guys were the worst sort of tabloid journalism, you know, led arguably to U.S. involvement in the Spanish-American War. Some would make that argument. And then they realized, oh, well, you know, that sells until it comes back and bites us. We actually have a long-term interest in keeping people and having them trust us. And it grew, and that from competition and everything else. We have to hold ourselves and each other to a higher expectation. It doesn't have to be that much higher at this point.
but a little bit higher. John, I take your point. David Mindich, what do you think?
I completely agree. I think we do have time to follow the news. We need to follow the news more. We need to get more serious. There's plenty of time in the day to watch cats on Roombas on Facebook, on YouTube. And yet we also need to know that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act are the same thing. We need to know these basic political facts. And until we step up, we're going to have politicians who will win by spouting generalities. And that's to kind of come back to Orion's point about propaganda. Propaganda finds a really good home in an uninformed citizenry. The people who really understand the news, really follow reputable news sources, are not going to be fooled as easily as others who will be fooled by the fake news that the Pope endorsed Trump or whatever.
Andrew's on the line with us from Middlebury. Hey, Andrew, go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to just bring up the point that we work in public relations here in Middlebury, and it's looking at the being big fans of journalism, the numbers around journalists to PR people is not favorable for getting the facts out. And it's my hope that over time, in the same way that you see Twitter verifying, you know, famous people, celebrities, people with large followings, that both makers of the news, whether they be PR people pushing out communications releases, and the journalists that are reporting on them are vetted somehow through a separate piece. Because at this point, the economics are driving us in that direction, and it's incredibly concerning to me.
Yeah, Andrew, I take your point as well, and this fuzzy line between PR and journalism, and you know the lack of funding that so many news sources have. That you know, basically, often people are reprinting press releases or rewording them and calling them news. Ryan Lewis, where do you think this is all going when you look ahead to where things stand now with journalism and civic engagement? What comes next?
Well, just to clarify my previous comments, I would love citizens to be active and engaged and fact-checking themselves. And I agree with the previous comments in that regards. But I think the media, I would say, has to find its identity as a watchdog again. And just like Edward R. Murrow emerged from, you know, the yellow journalism of the early 20th century, I think the media also has a responsibility to evaluate their own role and identity. And even under resource constraints, maybe some organizations will find that being a good watchdog or more investigative journalism might be good for their bottom line too. So that's what I think we're starting to see, and I hope we see more of.
Hmm. And David Mindich?
I agree. I think we citizens need to step up. The media needs to get more serious. The newsstand itself, which increasingly is Facebook, needs to promote quality news over the fake stuff. They've taken some steps with the new algorithms, but I think that they should privilege real news even more, giving part of their front page, the Facebook front page, over to traditional news in ways that they haven't yet.
Well, listeners, I appreciate your perspective on this. And Orion Lewis, David Mindich, I appreciate you both being here as well. Orion Lewis is a visiting professor in the political science department at Middlebury College. David Mindich is a professor of media studies, journalism, and digital arts at St. Michael's College. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's taken as conventional wisdom that young college graduates are moving back in with their parents in high numbers because of high student debt. But the reality seems to be a little more complicated. We'll fill you in next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Let's talk boomeranging, and not that favorite of Australian pastimes. I mean the tendency for college and post-college age students to move back in with their parents. With the average college graduate debtor owing $30,000 in student loans, the general assumption has been the higher the debt, the more likely the student to boomerang home. Well, Jason Houle is an assistant professor of sociology at Dartmouth College. He recently completed a study with Montana State sociology professor Cody Warner testing this assumption, and he's here to tell us a little bit more about what they found. Jason Houle, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Are young people moving back in with their parents at a higher rate than in the past?
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the case based on the data. We think that rates of boomeranging or ending up back on your parents' doorstep has at least doubled in the past generation. So it's certainly gone up, and that's led to a lot of speculation exactly about why that is.
Yeah, and a lot of the speculation was, well, it's just student debt. If you owe a lot, you're going to move back in with your parents. And you were testing that premise. How true is the premise?
I would say it's about half true. So I would kind of back up and say when we hear about student debt in the media or in policy worlds, we tend to hear two different sides of a debate. On the one hand, we hear student loan debt is crushing a generation. The sky is falling, right? On the other hand, there's a lot of folks who say, no, it's not really student debt. It's not a crisis. We should instead be worried about things like predatory for-profit colleges and dismal completion rates. And I would say our study kind of lands squarely in the middle. We kind of say, well, it's actually a little bit of both, and it depends on who you're talking about.
Okay, so give us a couple of the headlines here about what you found about what actually determines whether a young person is likely to move back in or not.
Yeah, so a couple of things that's important. When we started looking at the data, we kind of found no real evidence or no correlation between student loan debt and boomeranging, which kind of surprised us. It's like, doesn't look like student loan debt matters for boomeranging. But then there's a caveat there. So we dug deeper into the data and we found that actually student debt was more consequential for some people than for others, and that broke down by race. So the second key finding here is that for black youth, student debt seems to really matter for returning home, and that wasn't the case for white young adults. So it looks like student debt is pretty burdensome for black youth and less so for white youth. I would say
Look at why that might be?
Well, yeah. So we have a lot of ideas about why that might be. And I think there's a few key reasons for this that sociologists and other folks tend to talk about when we're talking about student loan debt and race. So we could talk about that. So first, we know that black youth are a lot more indebted than white youth in pursuit of a college degree. Part of this is because black youth are coming from families that are more socially disadvantaged. For instance, their parents have less wealth, which is tied to a legacy of discrimination in this country. So basically, black youth just have to borrow a lot more to make up for the gap between their parents' resources and the rising costs of college.
And of course, you're looking at on average here.
On average, yes. And you know, there's other components as well. So it's also the case that black youth are more likely to attend for-profit universities or underfunded colleges, places that are associated with high levels of debt and also have high dropout rates and don't confer as many labor market advantages as your traditional sort of public or nonprofit private universities.
Okay, so you said that that was one key difference, that African American youth are more likely to move back in than white youth, and there are some factors that related to that. And there's other issues as well when you look at what might be a factor in somebody of any race moving back in.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I like how you kind of preface this by a lot of people think college graduates are sort of ending up back on their doorstep, parents' doorstep. But actually what we find is it's not the college graduates at all. It's actually the college non-completers. And college completion is really a big, big time predictor. I would say one of the strongest predictors of returning home in our study. And, you know, we know that nearly 50% of young people who start college don't finish within 6 years, and that those who don't are facing a really tough labor market. We've heard about how the labor market has sort of fallen off a cliff for high school grads and high school dropouts. The same is pretty much true for college non-completers. And so these are the folks who are floundering in the labor market and they end up back home.
And they presumably have debt as well. So not only did they not complete a degree, and that may be more tricky in the labor market, but they are also then saddled with debt?
Yeah, that's true. So it is the case that what we think of as a group of dropouts with debt are a growing concern in the social science community and I think more generally in society. And, you know, these are folks that might have like what we might think of as trivial amounts of debt. So think $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. But this is a group that has an extraordinarily high default rate. So even though they don't have as much debt that we would think is a whole lot of money, it's really hard for them to pay off. And part of that is because they don't have that credential that gives them access to these, you know, high-paying middle-class jobs.
And you found that that was true for people who didn't complete a degree, whether it was associate's, bachelor's, or even a master's degree?
That's right. So people who pursued a college degree of any type but did not leave with a college degree, these people are the ones that are most likely to end up back at their parents' doorstep.
There was another factor that you looked at that had seems to have an impact on whether someone moves back in at home with their parents. And it's interesting and intriguing to me because it's this question of adult roles. Has somebody transitioned into what might be in quotes called adult roles, like cohabitating with a partner or being married or having children? That actually has a bigger effect than might be considered on whether somebody's likely to boomerang or not.
Yeah, that's right. And in some ways, that's least surprising to us and probably least surprising to most of the listeners is, you know, demographers have talked for a long time, and I'm a demographer by training, so I have to give them a shout out, about this period of life known as the transition to adulthood, this time of life when young adults are leaving school and entering traditional adult roles, exactly as you said. And we find that young people who have transitioned into these roles that we traditionally look at, marriage, perhaps home ownership, full-time employment, they're much less likely to return home than those that remain single or floundering in the labor market and are otherwise perhaps doing less well economically.
But we're seeing that Americans are choosing to get married if they choose to get married at a later and later and later age. So is that what you think may be contributing, that some of these traditional adult roles are happening later on? So it's just that, you know, people move back in with their parents because they haven't reached that stage of life yet?
I think that's certainly a contributor. I mean, when we think about why it is young people are ending up back in their parents' household, it's simply because it's taking longer to do these sort to transition into these adult roles. And in fact, that's a big contributor that we find. And, you know, I've done previous research that sort of questioned this whole link between student loan debt and home ownership that was a big deal or people were talking about a while ago. And we basically found the same thing, that actually these transitioning, whether or not you've moved into these adult roles or not, seem to matter a heck of a lot more.
Did you ever move back in with your parents?
I did not, no.
So what made you want to do this study?
I guess for me is, you know, as a researcher, I'm really interested in thinking about how student loan debt may or may not matter for young people and what that means for inequality in the country. As a sociologist, we talk about that a lot. I think for me, a lot of my motivation for some of my recent research is there's so many claims out there, speaking about fake news earlier, that just aren't backed up by data. So my real inclination was just to say, you know, what do the data say about this? What do we find? Because we really want to know if we're going to develop policy around this or think about what the answers are. We really need to actually, you know, see what the evidence says.
Well, I really appreciate you telling us about this study. Jason Houle is an assistant professor of sociology at Dartmouth College. And for those of you who want to dig deeper, we have a link to his study with Cody Warner on college students moving back in with their parents at vpr.net. Professor Houle, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That wraps up today's show. Tomorrow, how to end homelessness in Vermont. We'll talk about a new report that looks at whether the state is on the right track in tackling homelessness and what it would take to get the job done. Send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Jake Rusnak directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.